A warning from BB, a goodbye from Babs, and a breakthrough for Boehner. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
And like to you, and link to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 66 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as expected, went before a joint meeting of Congress on Tuesday. He said a bad deal with Iran on its nuclear capabilities is worse than no deal.
For over a year, we've been told that no deal is better than a bad deal. Well, this is a bad deal. It's a very bad deal. We're better off without it.
Republicans and many pro-Israeli Democrats greeted him enthusiastically. But it was a speech that President Obama said he wouldn't listen to, that Vice President Biden missed because he was, conveniently, out of the country, and that more than 50 Democrats decided to boycott. It's hard to see what good comes to Israel if U.S. policy becomes partisan. The gig is up for those Republicans who are holding hostage the funding for the Department of Homeland Security because of President Obama's actions on immigration. For weeks, Republicans in the House said they would only vote to fund the department if all the money going for Obama's immigration actions were taken out. But Democrats in the Senate said they would never agree to that and kept filibustering the bill. With one deadline having come and gone and another rapidly approaching, Speaker John Boehner conceded defeat. On Tuesday, the House voted for a clean bill that fully funds Homeland Security through the end of the budget year, with no language about immigration attached. Angry conservatives in the House say their speaker caved. Speaking of conservatives, the annual CPAC meeting took place last weekend. For the third straight year, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul won the straw poll. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker came in a close second. And for those keeping score, Jeb Bush finished fifth, and Chris Christie came in 10th. And Ben Carson, a former pediatric neurosurgeon who finished fourth in the straw poll, announced on Tuesday that he's formed a presidential exploratory committee. If elected, he'd be the nation's first African-American president since Barack Obama. And while polls might show that she's got a clear path to the Democratic nomination, Hillary Clinton was rocked by a New York Times article suggesting she broke federal rules while she was Secretary of State. She used a personal email account to conduct government business. That goes against record-keeping rules. Whether rules were broken or not, and Clinton defenders say they were not, it once again feeds into the narrative, rightly or wrongly, that there is a lack of transparency to her actions, that much of what she does is secretive and hidden from the public. Critics point to the fact that Clinton aides were the ones who decided which emails would be given to the State Department and which ones would not, adding to the suspicions. Finally, in a surprise announcement, Senator Barbara Mikulski said she would not seek a sixth term next year. The 78-year-old Maryland Democrat is the longest-serving woman in congressional history. She was first elected to the Senate in 1986 and the House for 10 years before that. Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland who was considering a presidential bid in 2016, says he's not interested in her spot. But others are, including Congressman Chris Van Hollen. The last time Republicans won a Senate seat in Maryland was 1980. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Barbara Mikulski has been in the Senate for 28 years. Which woman is in second place in all-time Senate seniority? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner, as always, will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. And if you want a sneak peek and a head start on each week's trivia question, plus daily updates on the latest news we're following, head over to our Facebook page. We post the question there a day early. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a fierce opponent of the Obama administration's efforts to conclude a nuclear arms deal with Iran, came to Capitol Hill on Tuesday. Netanyahu was invited by House Speaker John Boehner to speak to a joint meeting of Congress. The move was seen as a jab at Obama, whose relationship with the Israeli leader has been unsteady at times, to say the least. Netanyahu bemoaned the fact that some tried to politicize his speech, but the fact is, everything about it was political. Todd Zwillick is the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI. He was in the House chamber during Netanyahu's speech and joins us now. Todd, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hi, Ken. Great to be with you.
Thanks for coming in. Here's how Netanyahu opened his speech on Tuesday.
I know that my speech has been the subject of much controversy. I deeply regret that some perceive my being here as political. That was never my intention.
And then he added this.
The remarkable alliance between Israel and the United States has always been above politics. It must always remain above politics.
Todd, I mean, what he says is true, that it's always been above politics, but that doesn't seem to be the case any longer.
Yeah, what he says is not true. It has not always been above politics. That's just not true. And lots of times American candidates have tried to paint their adversaries of being no friend of Israel. We all know that. You know, anytime a politician, especially a professional politician of Benjamin Netanyahu's caliber and intelligence, says this has nothing to do with politics, write down in your notebook that it's about politics, because that's usually the number one protest that you hear from these guys. Look, I don't know what Benjamin Netanyahu necessarily intended, but there isn't anyone in the Capitol, hardly Republican or Democrat, who wasn't aware, Ken, of the major political implications of what Netanyahu was doing, not only here in the United States, but maybe more importantly in Israel. He has an election coming up in 2 weeks. We all know that. That was the main reason the White House gave for high American officials, including the president, not meeting with Netanyahu while he's in town, because we don't like to appear to interfere in foreign elections. That's the pretext, of course. They didn't meet with him because they're really ticked off because of the violations of protocol and the perception from the White House and from Democrats that Netanyahu was here to try to derail an Iranian nuclear deal that he doesn't like, but he was also here with his timing and his accepting of the invitation from Speaker John Boehner directly to drive a wedge on Israeli politics between Republicans and Democrats. So that perception kind of cuts against his plea that the politics of Israel has always been above partisanship in America.
There was a lot of discussion about who was using whom. And of course, a lot of people said, well, the Republicans were using Netanyahu to give a poke at President Obama and getting back at how President Obama is using his executive actions to go beyond Congress. Whereas at the same time, Netanyahu was using Congress to give his own poke at President Obama, given their differences on the settlement issue and things like that. So both sides seemed to use each other quite readily, didn't they?
Yeah, I was going to say, why differentiate when they can all use each other? Yeah. It doesn't have – those things are not mutually exclusive. I mean, politics, like nuclear deals, are about mutual interest, right? And you can maybe see the parallel there if John Boehner was using the appearance of Netanyahu to drive a wedge and isolate the president from the American public and say the one guy in America who doesn't get how dangerous Iran is the president of the United States. That's sort of the subtext of the invitation, if you like. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader, made clear after the speech how uncomfortable and upset she was at the lecturing tone. And the fact that Netanyahu was instructing the United States not only on how dangerous Iran is, but also on what its interests should be. So, you know, interest and defining of interest cuts a lot of different ways, both in politics and in nuclear deals.
Well, it's fair to say that Netanyahu definitely does bring a fear of Iranian access to nuclear weapons and the future of Israel's stability. I mean, Iran, is, of course, has vowed to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, as Netanyahu mentioned in his remarks to Congress. But what I'm asking you is, so who do you think the real audience was for Netanyahu's remarks? Obviously, it wasn't Congress, because the Republicans were on his side from the beginning. Who do you think the real audience was?
You know, that's a really interesting question. In the first audience, I suppose, since he's got an election in 2 weeks, has to be his voters or putative voters back in Israel in his own election that's coming up. I mean, it's hard to imagine, again, a politician of Netanyahu's caliber and ability doing anything with his schedule and his time and his public appearances so close before an election where he's in a bit of trouble and is kind of fighting for his current term and his political life there, doing something that's not to his direct benefit in domestic politics. I mean, otherwise he should be home campaigning and doing what he needs to do with Israeli voters. And I'm certainly no expert there.
Todd, you were talking about how the initial audience could very well be the voters back home in Israel, but Israelis also know that the last thing that Israel wants is deterioration of relations with the United States. And there are some people who say quite correctly that the poor relationship between Netanyahu and Obama has made the relationship between the two countries not more tenuous than ever, but with some question marks involved.
But Ken, that's been part of the concern around Congress, which is that the speaker inviting the prime minister directly and then the prime minister not notifying the State Department and the White House directly, which is protocol and kind of isolating the president away from his primacy in diplomacy and national security matters and foreign affairs, is a poisoning of the relationship and something that some members of Congress have intimated is somewhat conspiratorial. They don't like that. And they don't like many of them, I would say mostly Democrats, in this sense. A lot of the Republicans were kind of on board with this. Democrats, for the most part, don't like the identification of support for Israel with the neocon kind of Republican cause. And that's bothering a lot of them. There's no doubt, and maybe there's nothing wrong with the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu is politically and ideologically identified with the Republican neocon national security ethos.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second, because that's what I meant earlier when I said that, sure, this has always been about politics, but I don't recall a support for Israel ever been identified with one party over another party before. That's what I meant. I'm sure candidates have always attacked their opponents saying you're not pro-Israel enough. But I don't remember support for Israel being a D versus R issue.
No, you don't. And the frustration among a lot of Democrats, you see them when they do their TV hits and radio interviews, they have to preface every statement, I'm just as pro-Israel as the next person. And a lot of the Democrats who were mad that Netanyahu's coming also don't like the Iran deal. It doesn't necessarily cut in partisan ways.
I was going to ask you about that, too, because there are members of Congress from both parties who are fearful that the terms given to Iran, and again, as you point out, we don't know what the terms are, but they feel that they may be too favorable, too many concessions to Tehran.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of this is a lot murkier than even the picture of Republicans are happy Netanyahu's there, Democrats are not happy, and 50 of them don't show up. That does not tell you the full picture of not only support for Israel, but also support or lack thereof for the deal that the White House may be making in the P5 plus one.
So what's Todd, what's next for Congress? What can Congress do regarding approving, disapproving this treaty?
One of the most striking things in the chamber about Netanyahu's praise for Obama during sort of the throat-clearing section of his speech was how it sort of drove several Republicans into an uncomfortable position of actually applauding for the president they so staunchly oppose. I mean, like in State of the Union-style speeches, you're kind of used to the room being divided. One side applauds, one side doesn't. Here was a speech that so many Republicans were hooting for and cheering for and really literally standing on their feet to cheer for Netanyahu and the things he was saying. And then when Netanyahu necessarily at the beginning of his speech praises the support that Obama has given his country, these Republicans sort of many of them looked around like, do I clap? That's good. God, I don't know. And it was a really sort of physically uncomfortable moment where they felt like they had to applaud the president.
But you know, of course, why Netanyahu had to do that, of course, because he wasn't there to bash the president.
Of course.
Yeah.
Sure. Had to make that clear.
Okay. So what can Congress do? What is Mitch McConnell suggesting now?
Well, there have been a lot of bills floating around for a long time. Look, like we said, there are a lot of members of Congress who are skeptical of the entire premise of the P5+1 negotiation and of the easing of sanctions that could come along with a sort of deal with Iran. And we don't know exactly what that deal is going to be, but maybe we know some of the broad outlines of it. You've had a lot of bipartisan bills floating around of all different kinds, some that would immediately ratchet down on sanctions on Iran to make it even tougher for them to walk away from the table or to make the U.S. get a better deal, bills that would ratchet down sanctions immediately if there's no deal, and lots of other bills too. Now, the latest one, which is sponsored primarily by Bob Corker, he's a senator and he's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, basically gives congressional review for any deal that Obama and Kerry might make in Geneva with Iran. It basically says the deal has to be submitted. By the way, this is not a treaty, so the Senate doesn't get a crack at it automatically. Right. It's an international agreement, not a treaty, technically. That only matters because senators don't get to vote on it if it's an international agreement. So the Corker bill says this deal will have to be submitted to Congress, where we can vote to approve or disapprove it. And then later on, we, not the president, have control, more control over the dialing up and dialing back of sanctions according to Iran's behavior under the deal. Now, the White House has been completely against any of this. Of course, it takes away some of their power. That part's not hard to understand. But the timing has been important, too. A lot of Republicans have been pushing for ratcheting up not only on the review, but maybe on the sanctions or the threat of sanctions in the advance of a deal. And the White House says, the president says, if you do that, what you are doing is upending the deal. We have an interim agreement with Iran. That agreement is predicated on no more sanctions while we're talking, that Iran has to have some guarantee that the economic sanctions that already has slapped on it won't get worse while we're trying to reach an agreement. So if you do this, you're killing the deal. Give us more time. And when the president said that, you know, the Republicans basically don't much care for that argument. But the Democrats who support a tougher approach on Iran and some who are even very skeptical of the president's deal said, okay, well, we'll take you on the timing. And they refused to grant their votes to Mitch McConnell to go forward with any kind of bill before the March 24th deadline, basically saying, okay, you have until this deadline. The president has the time he's asking for. We're not going to vote for more sanctions before then, maybe after, but we won't kill the deal before you can even make it. We'll at least get to see the deal. That's how we got here. Now, where are we this week? Because this is important. Netanyahu gives his speech. He leaves the House floor. Senator McConnell comes to the microphones just like an hour or two later and says, next week, the Corker bill, this congressional review with maybe additional sanctions, we're going to bring that up next week. And you say, wait a second, hang on. The deadline's not until March 24th. We've already talked about this. McConnell says, nope, we're going to try to bring that bill up and we're going to debate this while the issue's hot and see where senators stand.
So while Obama is trying to work out a deal with Iran, maybe he should be working on a deal with McConnell as well, huh?
Oh, no, there is no deal. I mean, in this case, it doesn't look like Obama necessarily has to work out a deal with McConnell because the timing here has already caused the several Democratic supporters who support Corker and are co-sponsoring his bill to say, no, 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 we've already said we're not doing this. We're not going to vote. Now, just a little bit on Senate procedure. We won't spend a lot of time on it, but you got to know, of course, you want to get to a bill like this, it takes 60 votes. McConnell has 54 Republicans. He needs six Democrats to vote with him to advance to any bill. And that's what makes the decision to go with this now so very curious. They already have sort of a tacit agreement around the Senate that says we're not going to do anything before March 24th, even if we disagree with the sanctions regime and what the president is doing vis-a-vis Iran. And then along comes McConnell and says, nope, we're going to push ahead and try to get that bill. Well, Senator Bob Menendez, who's co-sponsoring Corker's bill, by the way, and several other Democrats who support the bill and want more review on Obama are saying, no, we're going to block this. You're not going to get cloture. We're going to filibuster this bill. And we don't understand your timing on this. And that's sort of the very curious part about it.
When the deal is completed, and we assume that's in a couple of weeks, there's going to be tremendous pressure on those Democrats who would side with the Corker Amendment, but also getting pressure from the White House.
That's definitely true, Ken, and that's a question of timing as well. Look, if there's a deal, first of all, we don't know that there'll be one. Let's assume that there will be. You know, look, ultimately Congress is going to have to weigh in one way or the other, even if it's not on this deal precisely. And here's why. Even if you look, Obama has said, if you guys pass a bill that says congressional review within 60 days, I'll just veto that. So you're not going to get that anyway. So maybe that won't affect this deal tomorrow or the next day. But any long-term deal with Iran is going to require sanctions to be lifted. That's the whole reason Iran's at the table, right? It's in their interest to give up any aspirations or appearance of aspirations for nuclear weapons because they are under crippling economic sanctions, not only from the United States, but from the rest of the world who's on board. Everybody's kind of unified right now on sanctions. And the rest of the world, by the way, doesn't want stronger sanctions. And so Obama's worried that if Congress puts new sanctions on, everybody else will bolt. That's a problem. But in the long run, the president has some power under the law to dial back on some sanctions, according to diplomacy. But he can't make them go away. He can't lift them. Only Congress can do that. That's the law. The banking and oil and trade sanctions that are on Iran now, it's going to take Congress eventually to legally make those go away. So even if this current impasse isn't broken, and even if Congress doesn't start to weigh in or even try to undo a deal that Obama and Kerry make with Iran now, eventually they're going to have to be dealt in.
Todd Zwillick is the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI. He's on Twitter at Todd Zwillick, Zwillich. Todd, thanks a lot for being on The Political Junkie.
Yeah, you got it, Ken. Anytime.
We always enjoy spending a lot of time covering CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, which held its annual meeting last weekend. It's long been a place to watch conservatives in action, and it's always more interesting watching what goes on there when there's a Democrat in the White House, or when a presidential election is on the horizon. Both scenarios apply this year. The headline to come out of last week's meeting is that, for the third year in a row, Senator Rand Paul won the CPAC straw poll. But was the straw poll the most interesting thing about the gathering? For that, we go to David Keene, the opinion editor for The Washington Times. He's the former chair of the American Conservative Union. David, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's focus on the straw poll for just a bit. We know Rand Paul won it, as expected. And between Rand Paul and Ron Paul, they've won the CPAC straw polls 5 out of the last 6 years.
Well, a lot of young people come to CPAC, and a lot of the young people tend to be more libertarian than the older attendees, and they tend to vote in these straw polls. So that doesn't really surprise me. What the real news out of the straw poll is often who's up and who's down, what trends are taking place under that. And it is a straw poll, after all, Ken. It's not a poll. It doesn't tell you what Republican primary voters are thinking at this point. It tells you what the attendees, the activists that these folks are trying to recruit, are thinking right now. And the news this week, of course, is CPAC came really in the middle of a mini surge that's going on for Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker. So he surged from way down in the poll last time to way up in the poll, almost matching Rand Paul without the benefit of Rand Paul's volunteer army that shows up at the conference every year.
Well, you know something, that's interesting too, because I'm hearing more and more talk about Scott Walker lately than any other potential candidate. He got a great response during the Iowa Freedom Summit a couple of months ago in Des Moines. How's he looking to you?
Well, he looks pretty good. He's got more upside potential, at least at the beginning, than some of the other candidates can, for this reason. In order to get the nomination of the Republican Party, and in this sense, the Republican Party, while not the same as, but similar to the conservative movement, you have to be able to reach into what Ronald Reagan used to call the three legs of conservatism: free market economics, social conservatism, and strong national defense. And among the governors in particular, Scott Walker is the only one, unless Mike Pence were to run, which I don't think he will, but he's the only one that has a leg up on I guess that's not the right word, but a leg up on reaching all of these legs. He's the son of a minister. He's clearly a social conservative. His economic positions are very compatible with the free market wing of the movement, and he appears to want to be tough on foreign policy, so that resonates there.
Well, let me play a little snippet of Walker at last week's CPAC.
And up the way in Washington, we have a president who draws lines in the sand and fails to act, a president who calls ISIS the JV club, who calls Yemen a success, and who calls Iran a country we can do business with, and to add insult to injury, whose former Secretary of State actually gave a reset button to the Russians, a reset button. We need a leader in America who stands up and realizes that radical Islamic terrorism is the threat to our way of life and to all freedom-loving people around the world.
You know, it was interesting, David, that he focused that much on foreign policy. I guess as a governor, maybe foreign policy credentials is always suspect, and he seemed to focus on that more. But I think most conservatives know him and the fact that he was targeted by the unions for that recall campaign in 2012 and survived quite nicely.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, every non-incumbent, and particularly every governor that runs for president, is criticized by his opponents for not knowing much about foreign policy. Ronald Reagan, ironically, is now known to history as a successful foreign policy president. But when he was running for president the first time, he was derided for having no foreign policy experience and no particular expert knowledge in that area. So that's a natural criticism, and a candidate who is in fact running from a governor's office has to in some way demonstrate that he has some grasp of the facts of what's going on outside the borders of the United States, and that he's got the kind of temperament and leadership capabilities necessary to provide what voters are looking for and to provide indeed what the country needs. So in that sense, it's not unusual that Walker would put some of these things in the forefront, because he doesn't really need to emphasize his courage in standing up to public sector unions, his ability to handle and attract voters in what is considered a blue state, or his social conservative background. What he does need to do is enhance over time the perception that he's somebody that can handle foreign policy and defense matters.
He probably also needs to be able to handle the kind of questions that the national media will throw at him, I guess, because he is the flavor of the month. But we saw that, you know, after Rudy Giuliani wondered whether President Obama loves America or not, so immediately the media would run to Scott Walker. What do you think about that? Or do you think that President Obama was a Christian? And he said, I don't know. Scott Walker, has to know that he's going to get these kind of questions and has to know how to respond to them, doesn't he?
Well, there's a dual question here. The press was very upset that he wouldn't respond to those questions, that he said, I've never talked to the president. I'm not Rudy Giuliani. I'm talking about the things I talk about. One thing this guy learned, and one thing a candidate has to be able to do, and he learned this in Wisconsin during the recall, is he's extremely focused. He's a candidate who wants to talk about what he wants to talk about and doesn't jump into every rabbit hole that's in front of him. The exact opposite, remember, in the last cycle in the Republican nomination struggle, when Rick Santorum saw his open window, he did jump into every rabbit hole. And pretty soon he was playing on somebody else's field rather than his own. So there's a balance that has to be made there. You know, one of the advantages, and we saw this again in the last cycle, is one of the advantages of the longer process that we go through, and people always complain, there are always columns about how it ought to be much shorter and that it's tiring and all that. One, it's educational, however, for the candidates. Imagine if Jimmy Carter had never had to run in primaries around the country, he wouldn't have known anything. Maybe he didn't learn a lot, but wouldn't have known anything except Georgia and peanut farming. He learned about the candidates learn about the diversity of the country, but they also, in essence, get to open in New Haven rather than on Broadway, which means that as more and more people focus, they have a chance to get their act together, to rewrite the third act, if you will, so that they can succeed. The danger of skipping all that was evident in the last cycle when Rick Perry opened on Broadway and didn't get a chance to rewrite the last act because he stumbled, and he stumbled under the lights in front of everybody. The candidates who start early in Iowa and go through all that they're going through now managed to figure out in the course of it how to handle and how to recover from the stumbles that are inevitable, particularly in today's world, because, you know, before 2000 and in the 80s and even the 70s, when I was much more active with presidential candidates, you could stumble and nobody know about it. Today, one word, one sentence delivered wrongly in the wrong place, and you can be mortally wounded. So it's even more dangerous now than it was then.
Yeah, I was thinking about that like 4 years ago, and it lead up to the straw poll, not even the Iowa caucuses, but the Iowa straw poll. Tim Pawlenty, who seemed to have a national campaign ready to go, stumbled in the straw poll, and he was gone.
That's right.
Michelle Bachmann, who won the straw poll, stumbled, and she was gone by the time we got to the caucuses a few months later.
That's exactly right, and that's what can happen. And it frankly, it does happen more now than it did then, because we now live with incredible focus. Everybody, if you go out to campaign, I was out with a number of candidates in this last cycle, and they've all got their stalker. I don't know what they call them, but they've all got somebody from the other party and the other candidate following them around.
The macaca moment, right?
Waiting to get that. And yeah. Every candidate gets tired, whether they're Republicans or Democrats or liberals or conservatives, they get tired. They make a statement that they wouldn't want to make. Famously, the Romney 47% statement in the last cycle, and then in this cycle, the congressman from Iowa who said he had to win to keep win the Senate seat to keep that farmer Grassley from being head of the Judiciary Committee.
Right, Bruce Braley.
But in a week, he lost 20 points. Now, he was probably tired. He didn't think there was somebody there with a camera, just like Mitt Romney didn't. But you have to be, if you're a candidate, you have to be on guard and sharp every second in today's world, because a momentary lapse can kill years of work.
And obviously we saw that with President George Allen when he was running for president, or at least running for re-election in 2006, and had that macaca moment.
That's right, and I remember running into him, and this goes to the rabbit hole question, and I said, George, did your father, the famous football coach, ever teach you self-discipline? You know, and he said, well, they won't let me talk about other things. I said, that's not their job. You know, that's your job, is to get it back on the subject that you want to be talking about. But so many candidates, and this is something that Walker from Wisconsin has been resisting, so many candidates go off and make things worse, because when they stumble, then they get 13 questions. And the whole controversy becomes about something that nobody cares about except them and the person questioning them, but it shows that they can't handle it. So it requires you to be on guard all the time, and it requires you to be able to keep your eye on the ball.
You mentioned earlier Jeb Bush, and I saw that he finished fifth in the straw poll. When he stepped up to the podium, he heard a lot of boos, and I think I've heard many times that I think at the Freedom Summit back in Iowa a few months ago, when Donald Trump, of all people, mentioned Jeb Bush, it was received with boos. I think by many standards, Jeb Bush was a very, very conservative governor of Florida. But
he certainly was. He was a great governor, and he was a conservative governor. I wrote a piece, Ken, when he indicated he was going to run for president, and I said when Jeb left Tallahassee, he was the conservative former governor of Florida, and he has somehow morphed into the former conservative governor of Florida.
Do you think that's fair? Do you think that's accurate?
No, I'm not sure it is fair, and I'm not sure it is accurate, but he's allowed it to happen. Part of what he did since leaving office was a mistake, and that's he didn't know when to get off the Common Core federal standards. He was a great education governor. He quite correctly believed in that the need for standards. And then as President Obama took a good idea and turned it into a federal mandate and started pressuring states to adopt it, he didn't know where to get off. And so it got to the point where he was in agreement with President Obama and went to the extent that George Will wrote that that alone disqualified him from being president because he didn't understand federalism. That was a mistake. The other thing was he clearly, during the interim period, wasn't thinking of running for president. I don't think his position on immigration has changed very much, but if he were thinking of running, he would have been emphasizing those things that conservatives would stand up and cheer him for. Instead, he was emphasizing exactly those things where there were major differences between his position and the positions of the voters he was seeking. That wasn't necessarily a mistake. That was because I don't really think he was contemplating a run for the presidency during most of this period. He's got other problems as well. He's got the same problem in one sense that Hillary Clinton has, and that is that they're sort of yesterday's candidates. He also has the problem recently he was criticized in one of the conservative magazines because he suggested maybe in spite of all of our belief in lower taxes, he wouldn't sign a no increased pledge, and we should contemplate taxes. Well, conservatives look at it and say, "We saw your father do it."
Read my lips.
You know, and so he's got, as anybody who comes from the position he comes from, where he's got a brother and a president with mixed records in the eyes of most voters, and particularly of Republican primary voters, he's got a legacy problem. He's got overall the question of whether he's really playing today's game or yesterday's game. And then he's got to show reach into these various areas that he hasn't been able to reach into in the past. But he's a bright guy. And interestingly, Ken, you'll appreciate this because of your appreciation of the history of presidential campaigns. His father, in the 1980 campaign, when he was challenging Ronald Reagan for the nomination, had the problem that he couldn't deliver a very good speech. He was not a particularly good speaker, and he adopted what they called Ask George Bush events, which were essentially sort of orchestrated town halls where he wouldn't have to give a speech, but he could just answer questions because he was a smart guy, and he could do that, and he performed much better in that context. Last time Jeb was at CPAC, he delivered one of the worst speeches that I've ever witnessed, and I'm told that his speech recently in Chicago was terrible. He showed up this time, and he said, "I don't want to give a speech. I want to answer questions." One suspects that he was at Sunday dinner with his father and said, "What did you do about this?"
Well, I think what we were referring to at CPAC, Sean Hannity was doing the interviewing, and actually he referred to the thing you mentioned about the Bush legacy in the White House. Here's a little bit of the
right.
Tape.
We've had your dad and your brother as President of the United States. You made a statement the other day. You said, "Well, wait a minute. I am my own man."
Yeah, so if I go beyond the consideration of the possibility of running, which is the legal terminology that many of the people here coming to CPAC are probably using to not trigger a campaign, if I get beyond that and I run for president, I have to show what's in my heart. I have to show that I care about people, about their future. It can't be about the past. It can't be about my mom and dad or my brother, who I love. I love them all. It has to be about the ideas that I believe in to move our country forward so that we can have high sustained economic growth where more people have a chance at earned success, because in America today, more and more people don't think that system works for them anymore. And for conservatives to win, we need to give them hope that if we create the field of dreams, that people can rise up again.
You know, sometimes it feels like he knows that he should say things that conservatives will like, but then he gets caught in all these parentheticals that just mutes his message.
Well, Jeb Bush is a very smart guy, and both as governor and since then, he's more a policy wonk in many ways than a politician. He's actually said in terms of speaking that he's sort of introverted in that sense. So he's a guy who doesn't live in a world of black and whites, but in a world of grays because of his. On this, you know, there's always this on the one side and on the other, and he's looking at it. That's the sign of a smart guy. It's not necessarily the sign of a smart politician.
Well, I'm not going to put you on the spot, but there are 11 months to go before Iowa and New Hampshire, and hopefully we'll have you on the program many times before then. But 11 months to go. Right now, who's jumping out at you? Who's jumping out at you as a perhaps nominee?
Well, I thought then, and I think now, one of them's eliminated himself. I thought then that the two potential candidates that had the most the best possibility of reaching into those various pots of votes were Mike Pence of Indiana and Scott Walker of Wisconsin. I think that every presidential cycle is in some ways a reaction to the previous cycles. And I think that in Barack Obama, the voters sensed that they bought the sizzle and didn't get much steak, that he didn't have a background where he could handle things, and they're going to be looking for somebody who can. And I think that means they want a governor. After all, that's why Mike Pence, I think, left Congress and went back to succeed Mitch Daniels in Indiana so he could get that on his resume. But I think a governor has a leg up on a senator. And I think those are the two most likely. I think Chris Christie, not because of his highway problems or the rest of it, I think he's got a cultural problem in connecting with voters around the country. But I think he's in the mix. On the other hand, you're going to have, if Rand Paul runs, and he no doubt is going to run, he'll have money because he's got a bunch of people that are going to put some money into it. Ted Cruz has got Texas, so they can stay in it. But I don't see them being capable of reaching out and putting together what you need at the end of the day.
David Keene is the opinion editor for The Washington Times and the former chair of the American Conservative Union. David, it was great having you back on the show.
It's always a pleasure, Ken.
CPAC is only one of the events where Scott Walker has made a big impression. He also got strong reviews at the Iowa Freedom Summit in Des Moines, which was attended by many conservative and evangelical leaders in the nation's first caucus state. Not long after being elected governor of Wisconsin in 2010, he worked to end collective bargaining rights for public employee unions. That led to a fierce response from organized labor, which arranged massive demonstrations at the state capitol and put a recall effort against him on the ballot. When Walker beat back that recall campaign in 2012, he became the darling of national conservatives. But for him to advance to higher office, he needed to do one more thing: win re-election in 2014. That he did. We brought in Craig Gilbert, the Washington bureau chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, to talk all things Walker. Craig Gilbert, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Nice to be with you.
Well, much of the early buzz of 2016 is all about Walker. How do you explain that?
Well, he has a narrative, as they say in politics, that is irresistible to a lot of Republican primary voters. I mean, forget about his personality, forget about his all the things that have happened since he took off in this race, but his story of the last few years of winning 3 times in 4 years in a state that's been voting Democratic for president, taking on and defeating the public employee unions, is a pretty compelling set of facts if you're a conservative activist or a Republican primary voter. I think that explains his buzz more than anything else.
Now, Democrats, of course, in Wisconsin will say that much of his 4+ years have been more of a failure than anything else. How would you assess his time as governor?
In political terms, they've been a huge success. I mean, as we kind of alluded to, I mean, he's really taken over the state for his party. The Republicans have come in. They have a lock on the legislature, partly thanks to redistricting. He's defeated key parts of the Democratic coalition, and he's won 3 elections. So there's no doubt that politically he's been hugely successful. They've passed a lot of bills that conservatives love. When you step back and say, you know, I think it's going to take years to assess the impact on the state, and it really is in the eye of the beholder. It depends on whether you think the things that he's done on all sorts of fronts are good or bad, and people will have different perspectives on this. There are, when it comes to the economy, the picture and jobs, the picture is somewhat mixed. I mean, he's running on the claim that he turned the state around, and he has some evidence for that claim, but also when you look at jobs numbers, the job gains that he promised when he ran in 2010 haven't materialized to the degree that he promised, and the state's private sector job growth has lagged behind the nation as a whole.
It's one thing to run statewide in Wisconsin, Craig. As you pointed out, the Republicans haven't won in a presidential race since 1984. It's another to run in Iowa and New Hampshire and seek Republican votes for president. Has Scott Walker's rhetoric changed since he was reelected last November?
Well, he's always been a pretty conservative politician. He was conservative when he was a state lawmaker. He was conservative when he was county executive in Milwaukee, and he has been a very conservative governor. But there have been some issues where he's moved to the right even more, issues where he either downplayed the issue during the campaigns or his position was more ambiguous. To give you a few examples, he just came out and said he would support legislation to ban abortion after 20 weeks. When he was asked about that during the campaign, he was much more noncommittal about it, and he kind of avoided taking a firm stand on that.
Didn't he say at one point that I'm pro-life, but it's still up to the woman and her doctor?
He said that in a television ad, and what he's saying is that he was merely describing the state of the law when he said that, but the atmospherics and the tone of that ad were pretty unmistakable. I mean, that was an ad that was designed to kind of defuse the issue and reassure people who didn't necessarily agree with him on abortion, that this wasn't the issue that was the central issue for him. He's always been pro-life, so it's not really an inconsistency in his policy views so much as the fact that, you know, there were issues where he certainly de-emphasized during the campaign or wouldn't take a position during the campaign. He's now giving them a little bit more emphasis and he's taking a firmer position. Another example is right to work, where he was always in favor of right to work, but he said many times during these campaigns that he didn't want a bill to advance, and now he's ready to sign that bill. And immigration is another one. He's defined himself first and foremost on these other issues, on the union issues, on fiscal issues. And so I think that's made it possible for him to be pretty acceptable to moderate Republicans, as well as, you know, more than acceptable to conservative Republicans. So he's trying to strike a little bit of a balance and walk kind of a line here. And obviously, in a Republican presidential primary, there's more pressure on you to check all the boxes for conservative voters.
You mentioned right to work. Now, during the campaign, I think he was asked about that, and he said, well, there are more important issues that we need to worry about before we talk about right to work. And now suddenly, in the last couple of days, it's on the legislature's agenda.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear that he wasn't pushing for right to work to happen. He said many times during the campaign that he didn't think it would happen, that he wasn't he even said at some time he said at times he would work to make sure it didn't happen. He never said he was against it, because that was his record, was that he supported it in the past. But he was sending a signal to everybody that you don't have to worry about this. And then the Republican legislature went ahead anyway in the last couple of months and said, we're going to do this. And so I think he felt he had no choice but to say he would sign it as a Republican presidential candidate. That would be consistent with his historic position, and it would also bring him a lot of grief to veto a right-to-work bill when he's running in the Republican presidential nominating fight. But it is at odds with his rhetoric in the last two campaigns he ran in, where he was really – did everything he could to downplay the issue.
Although the fact is that since he came to national attention through his battling with the public employee unions, supporting right-to-work legislation would help support that image.
Well, it's consistent with that image, but it really doesn't bring him anything new, which is one reason why I think he didn't necessarily want to do it, because he's already got that identity and he's kind of getting as much as he can possibly get out of that. And the politics of doing right-to-work are a little different than going after public employee unions. I mean, private sector unions are less unpopular with independents and Republican voters than public employee unions. And he had more support. He's had more support as a governor among households in private sector unions than households in public sector unions. So he could pay some price for it. I don't think it's a cosmic issue for a lot of voters, but the politics are different, and the polling helps explain why he didn't really want to do it.
I asked David Keene this question earlier in the show. Let me ask you this, too. It seems like whenever there's something controversial going on in the Republican Party, reporters will go to Scott Walker to get a response. And we saw that with Rudy Giuliani wondering whether President Obama really loves America or not. one would think that if you're in the if you're the target or you're the leading Republican or the rising Republican, you'll be asked these kind of questions. And it seems like Scott Walker didn't answer it smartly.
Well, one thing you got to remember is this has all happened so quickly. It's happened more quickly than he could have imagined it happening. He was catapulted by this speech in Iowa. I mean, the underlying fundamentals were always there for him, and I think the potential was always there for him to gain a lot of traction in the invisible primary. But it just happened so quickly that I don't think he's been entirely prepared to talk about certain issues and entirely prepared for some of the questions that he's gotten. And he's also a very disciplined message guy who likes to answer the same questions the same way over and over again and likes to talk about things on his own terms. And so I think he was you know, when he kept getting the question about Rudy Giuliani and Giuliani's statement that Obama doesn't love America, he decided he didn't want to go there. And so it had the effect of keeping the issue alive because he wouldn't say the words that reporters are waiting for him to say, which is, of course, I'm not questioning the president's patriotism, but I don't see why I should have to talk about what somebody else has said. And he never went there. He went there very kind of begrudgingly in the Fox interview on Sunday. But it's an example, I think, of the way of one way in which he handles himself in the media. And another thing that's, you know, been at play here is that he's kind of a media hound. He's in the media all the time. He gives interviews all the time. He likes to give interviews. He likes to talk. And I think that's been pretty good for him in terms of his visibility. But at a certain point, you know, it may be too much of a good thing because he's constantly exposing himself to these kinds of questions. And as a consequence, it's been sort of a running saga.
Scott Walker got into a little hot water last weekend during his speech at CPAC. Critics said basically he was comparing the protesters who showed up in Madison to members of ISIS. Let's listen to that tape.
I want a commander-in-chief who will do everything in their power to ensure that the threat from radical Islamic terrorists do not wash up in American soil. We will have someone who leads and ultimately will send a message not only that we will protect American soil, but do not take this upon freedom-loving people anywhere else in the world. We need a leader with that kind of confidence. If I can take on 100,000 protesters, I can do the same across the world.
Now, everybody jumped and said that he's comparing the protesters who came to Madison mm-hmm. to the folks who were beheading people in the Mideast. Little harsh, maybe?
A little harsh, but you know, two things. A little bit of a tin ear on his part to how a statement like that might be heard by people outside the Republican base. And two, he is a governor, and governors don't have much in the way of a foreign policy credentials. And so he's had to kind of reach a little bit when he talks about foreign policy, not just in terms of the specifics of his foreign policy views, which are in the process of being formed, but also to talk about his own ability to be the commander-in-chief and to conduct foreign policy. And so he said a bunch of things that have been questioned about that. He's talked about how he's described Ronald Reagan's facing down the air traffic controllers as the most important foreign policy decision that Ronald Reagan made, because he was a governor in a battle with unions, and that sent a signal, he argues, to the rest of the world that this was a man to be taken seriously. There's been a lot of debate and reaction to that. And then this statement, I think, falls into the same vein, where he was basically having to make an argument about why he should be taken seriously as a potential commander-in-chief that had to do with, you know, obviously a domestic policy and his record as the governor of a state. And so he was reaching for kind of a leadership analogy, and that was his battle with the protesters.
We had Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota, on the show a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the comparisons, both Midwestern governors.
Right.
And he said that he sees one big difference is that his national acclaim during the recall campaign got him a lot of conservative money around the country. How's he doing with raising money?
Well, so yes, he's got this. It gave him a huge small donor and large donor network. Now, those large donors aren't automatically presidential donors, because the Wisconsin governor's race, the recall election, was a kind of a nationalized election where all kinds of conservatives and Republicans came in and gave him money. Some of those people were people that are supporting other candidates for president in the Republican race. And so those aren't all his donors, but some of them are. And it not only put him on the map, but it allowed him to sort of make these connections, and it put him in a better position to raise money than most governors. I have to wait and see what the reports say, but the anecdotal reports are that he's raising money, and I think money will be less a problem for him than a lot of the other Republican candidates not named Bush.
Do you know him at all? I mean, you talked about his access to the media. What's your relationship with him?
Pretty good. I write up a column, a kind of geeky political column about political trends and elections, and he's a political geek of sorts. He's a political junkie, I should say. And so the stuff I write about is
Wait, there's only one political junkie. I'm sorry.
Yes. But we have conversations about the stuff I do because he's into the subject. And so he's one of the things that's interesting about him as a politician is he's not only a kind of a policy guy and a political guy, but he's, like I said, he's got a kind of certain comfort level with the media and he likes politics and he kind of eats and breathes politics. And so I think that gives him a comfort level with the political media, which you don't always see, but is certainly there. And he's got a long history in Wisconsin of being in the media.
If he doesn't succeed for the Republican nomination, there are no term limits in Wisconsin. Do you see him running for governor again in 2018, or that's a million years from now?
It's a long way from now. And, governors, he's run. I counted this up the other day. This will be his 14th campaign in 25 years. He's never gone more than 2 years in his life, in his adult life, without running an election campaign. So that's been his history. If he doesn't make it this time around, that history would suggest he'll be running for something else in another 2 years, which could be re-election as governor. Tommy Thompson was, won 4 elections for governor in Wisconsin and was there for 14 years. So it certainly seems like a possibility. He's it would also kind of maintain his viability as a future presidential candidate. He's a pretty young guy.
And usually Republicans reward their candidates on the second time around.
Yeah, and he'd be that much more experienced, too. But it's a long way away.
Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's on Twitter at WisVoter, as in Wisconsin voter. Craig, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last person elected mayor of Chicago in their first run for public office? The answer, Jane Byrne. She was the head of Chicago's Consumer Affairs Department until Mayor Michael Blandick fired her in 1977. 2 years later, in an upset, she beat Blandick in the Democratic primary. She was defeated in her bid for re-election in 1983 by Harold Washington. Anyway, the winner is Paul Marnicek of North Royalton, Ohio. Paul wins the coveted political junkie button. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttle button puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and more. It's at krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. On Saturday, March 5th, 1977, President Jimmy Carter sat down in a yellow wingback chair in the Oval Office and did something no president had ever done. He took calls live on the air.
President, here in the Oval Office in Washington, let us remind you of the telephone number again. It's 900-242.
It was called Dial a President, or Ask President Carter, according to his records. And it was hosted by and the brainchild of longtime CBS anchor Walter Cronkite. Carter had about 20 minutes of practice time beforehand. The program lasted 2 hours, with more than 9 million people calling in to the toll-free number. It was the first and only live call-in program with a sitting U.S. president. 42 people got through to the Oval Office.
Thank you, Pete. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you, Mr. Bellani. The next question, Mr. President, is from Mark Fenrick of Brooklyn, New York. Mr. Fenrick, go ahead.
There was a 6.5-second delay. Emerson Stone, a CBS News executive, personally manned a kill switch if a caller said something inappropriate to the president. Questions ranged from his daughter Amy's public school education to a gasoline tax to Cuba policy.
And do you think that normal relations to Cuba are possible within, again, the near future?
Well, there are varying degrees of relationships with Cuba. As you know, we have had some discussions with them in the past, for instance, on the anti-hijacking agreement, which expires this spring. And we now have no...
It aired on a Saturday afternoon and was considered a success by Carter and the CBS staff. But it never happened again, unless you kept the parody on Saturday Night Live featuring Dan Aykroyd as Carter and Bill Murray as Cronkite.
Yes, it is.
Do you have a question for the president?
I took some acid. I'm afraid to leave my apartment, and I can't wear any clothes. And the ceiling is dripping, and,
Well, thank you very much for calling, sir. Please.
No, just a minute, Walter. This guy's in trouble. I think I better try to talk him down. Peter?
Yeah.
It was 38 years ago this week that President Carter and Walter Cronkite, the real President Carter and Walter Cronkite, sat down for the Dial a President program on CBS.
Okay.
Just remember, you're a living organism on this planet, and you're very safe. You've just taken a heavy drug. Now, just relax, stay inside, and listen to some music, okay? Do you have any Allman Brothers?
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. This week, Barbara Mikulski announced she will not seek a sixth term as senator from Maryland.
This has been a hard decision to make. I have served in the Senate for a while, and at the conclusion of this term, I will have served over 30 years. That's hard to believe. And I want the people of Maryland to know there's nothing gloomy about this announcement. There's no health problem. I'm not frustrated with the Senate. The Senate will always be what the Senate is. But what I have decided that the best thing that I want to do is, where do I spend my time? I want to give 120% of my time focused on my constituents, because it's never been about me. It's always been about them.
First elected to the Senate in 1986, before that, Mikulski served 10 years in the House. That makes her the longest-serving woman in congressional history. Even though a Republican hasn't won in Maryland since 1980, her departure kicks off a battle that will be seriously fought by both parties. Melissa Deckman is a political science professor and the head of the political science department at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. Professor Deckman, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Barbara Mikulski is 78 years old, but the decision still came as a big surprise.
I would say yes. I think the talk around Maryland was that she was gearing up for a re-election in 2016, and by all indicators, she would have handily won re-election. So I think people were a little bit surprised at the announcement, at the timing of the announcement, too.
She said she didn't want to spend the next 2 years raising money, but does Barbara Mikulski ever need to raise a lot of money in Maryland?
She's so safe, it's hard to imagine that she'd have trouble raising money at all. I think, you know, part of it might be that she's just sort of worn out by the whole process. I think that many, especially former members of Congress, often bemoan the amount of time it takes to raise money, and it detracts them from really the main reason they go there, which is really to affect policy changes. So I suspect that part of this decision is maybe that she's still a little tired and fatigued of the whole process as well.
Tell me a little bit about Mikulski. What kind of a senator has she been, and what kind of a person is she?
Well, Senator Barb, as she's often called by many people in the know of Maryland politics, is really beloved by a lot of Marylanders across the spectrum. Even those who ideologically oppose her would acknowledge that she is a fierce advocate for the citizens of Maryland. She is really well known for being very good with casework and helping individual constituents around across the state. And I think many people would acknowledge, too, that especially in her role as the head of the Appropriations Committee, she's always been very good at making sure that Maryland gets its fair share when it comes to distributing federal dollars. And so Maryland is first and foremost on her mind.
But I also ask about what kind of a person because I always hear these things. Well, she may not be the nicest or most agreeable person in the room.
You know, she is feisty is often a term that we use to describe Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski. She has no airs about her at all. And I think in some respects, this authenticity, this kind of blue collar background really is unique in the Maryland in the U.S. Senate, certainly. And I think it kind of gives her a little bit of leeway to be maybe not so nice, I guess you could say. But people know it's genuine. They know that her interests are really about her constituents and the city of Baltimore in particular, but the state as well. And so I don't think they're necessarily as put off by her feistiness. In some ways, you know, she has sort of a Chris Christie way about her, of being blunt. And for some people, they find that quite appealing. And because I think that they know that she really cares about the state, and that's really where her heart is.
When she first came to the House in 1977, there were only 17 other women in Congress, and none of them were in the Senate. So I'm kind of torn over whether things have changed a lot since then or not enough.
Well, I will say one legacy that Barbara Mikulski will take with her is that she has been a big advocate for having more women elected to office. And she knows what it's like to serve as a very small minority, both within the House, and then when she moved over to the Senate, she was only one of two, along with Nancy Kassebaum, who was a moderate Republican from Kansas. And so she has long sort of talked about the importance of having more women run for office, and she's been a big champion. She goes out and she raises money for other women. She routinely works with Emily's List, which is an organization promoting more women in office. And so she's really recognized as the dean of the women in the Senate. And so I think that she thinks there's been lots of progress, but not nearly enough. Currently, just 20 members of the Senate are women. That's only 20%. And, you know, of course, women, in fact, make up more voters than men. And so she would say that we need more women, definitely.
There are three Democratic women up for re-election in 2016, and now two of them are retiring, both Barbara Boxer and Barbara Mikulski. I guess if your name is Barbara, you're retiring.
If you're 4'11", or if you're 4'11", they're both short.
right. The longest serving and the shortest, longest and the shortest. But Barbara, in California, Kamala Harris is the attorney general who's seen as an early front runner. Is there an early front runner female in Maryland?
Gosh, it is a pretty wide open race, which is one reason why I think the political junkies that listen to your show are going to be watching in Maryland. But I would say my eye is really on Donna Edwards. She is a member of Congress, a Democratic African-American. She really sort of took the establishment by storm a few years ago when she unseated Al Wynn, who was a long-serving incumbent. That's pretty unheard of in Maryland politics, to seat an incumbent. And so she's very savvy. Many people liken her to sort of a Ted Cruz on the right. She's sort of like a Ted Cruz of the Democratic Party. I didn't come up with it. I just read that online. But she's very progressive, and a lot of people are excited about her potential. And I think, you know, she would be the first African-American female to run for the Senate in Maryland, and I think her candidacy would generate a lot of enthusiasm. The question, of course, is can she raise the money? But given her unique position, I think that she probably would be able to raise the money. I think of all the women running, she's the one that I think has the best shot. Heather Mazier is someone else who's been mentioned. Heather Mazier is ran for governor, and she finished third in that race.
In the primary,
in the Democratic primary. But she ran a really great campaign. It was totally grassroots. She's very authentic. She's definitely progressive. And a lot of people felt that she handled herself quite well in that campaign. And she really sort of raised the attention of a lot of people outside of Maryland politics. So I would suspect she would probably have a good shot at raising some money as well.
Other Democrats mentioned include Congressman Chris Van Hollen, who has great connections and great money-raising ability, and Anthony Brown, who the former lieutenant governor. Do you think Brown has a possible comeback in him?
I think after that performance last fall, yeah, I would be shocked if he decided to run for Senate. He was a huge disappointment. And in fact, notably, you know, Barbara Mikulski had endorsed him. She rarely does that. And so for Brown to have blown that opportunity, I just can't imagine that he would run at this time around. I do think, however, that Chris Van Hollen is very interested. He served for a while as head of the DCCC, which is essentially had him around the country raising money. So I think that he has the ability to raise the kind of money. He's routinely featured on these Sunday talk show. He comports himself quite well. I think he is early on, if not a favorite, someone definitely to watch.
And there was one prominent Democrat who immediately took his name out of the running on Tuesday.
Yes. So former Governor Martin O'Malley, made a very quick announcement to say that he was not interested, essentially, in the Senate seat. He, of course, has been exploring whether or not to run for president. And so I think that he is placing those eggs in that basket and has decided that this seat is not for him. And plus, given last fall's results, I think a lot of people looked at that in terms of the governor's race, looked at that as a referendum on O'Malley's performance. A lot of people have been talking about O'Malley fatigue in the state of Maryland. So it's not a guarantee that he would have gotten the nomination or even won the seat in 2016. I think had he won, he probably would have been considered the favorite, but by no means a guarantee.
Now, I know that the Republicans elected a governor last year, which almost never happens in Maryland. As a matter of fact, I think there's a state law that prohibits Republicans from getting elected in Maryland.
But, only every couple of decades.
Right. Spiro Agnew, Bob Ehrlich, and right. But do they have a shot in the Senate race?
I would say probably not. And the reason is that Hogan's victory was because of a couple of unique circumstances.
Governor Larry
Hogan.
And part
of it. Governor Larry Hogan, yes, right. Sorry. So Governor Larry Hogan won last fall because there was record low voter turnout in lots of respects. And so, and he also faced Anthony Brown, who ran a pretty weak campaign. In 2016, you're going to have a presidential election occurring. The electorate in Maryland is going to look very different than it did in 2014. And so I think it benefits a Democratic candidate as opposed to a Republican candidate. You know, stranger things have happened, certainly, but I think that in 2016, Marylanders are likely to vote in a Democratic senator. And that's, in fact, I think part of probably why Barbara Mikulski decided to retire when she did, because her seat would have been open in a non-presidential election year if she decided to go for six more years. And so I think then it's a little bit more dicey as to whether Democrats could have kept that seat in 6 years from then.
Andy Harris, one of the few members of Congress, Republican members of Congress from Maryland, is talking about running. Do you think he'll give up his House seat to run?
You know, that's an interesting question. He's the only Republican member in the U.S. Congress right now and from the state of Maryland, and so a lot of people are looking at him. But in reality, he's very conservative. He's very different, for example, from Larry Hogan, who just won the gubernatorial election here in Maryland. Hogan is personally conservative on social issues, but does not sort of wear that on his sleeve, whereas Andy Harris is very conservative on social issues, but in fact advocates for policy changes that comport with that vision. So I think he's frankly too conservative for a presidential electorate. The other thing that Andy Harris has to consider is his stock is rising in the GOP. He's been kind of tapped by leadership to do lots of things. And so he has a unique opportunity to really shape policy if he stays in the House of Representatives. His seat is very safe, the First District of Maryland. So he would be giving up a lot to run what I think is probably a campaign that's going to favor Democrats.
In the end, what do you think people will remember most about Barbara Mikulski?
I think that people will remember her as a big advocate for women's rights. I think her signature piece of legislation, she sponsored the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which makes it easier for women to pay for back pay for sex discrimination in pay. And she's just been a fierce advocate for women in general. And so I think that that is really what people will remember from Senator Barb.
Melissa Deckman is a political science professor at Washington College. She's on Twitter at Melissa Deckman. Melissa, how do you come up with these great Twitter names? It's excellent.
I spent days on that one, yes.
Melissa, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was fun.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington, and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. And we have an opening here at The Political Junkie for an editor-producer. Go to our website for more details, krpoliticaljunkie.com. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer, and Timothy Olmsted is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.